Hello, everyone. Dan Dillman here, bringing you a little of this, a little of that. We're going to start today by going to Great Britain, to what I call Hedgeland. So welcome to Hedgeland. The streets of suburban Britain are edged with merry green, boxy bushes of privet, beech, holly, yew, and other plant species act as boundaries around gardens, demarcating property lines and separating our domestic and public lives in Britain. Town planners call them woody linear features, but they are so much more than that. They are a charmed circle drawn around family and self. What the white picket fence is to America, the hedge is to Britain, a cozy symbol of conservatism. The distinctive sound of a British summer, apart from the melancholy hiss of rain, is the insistent growl of the motorized hedge trimmer, the staccato rasp of hand shears. Hearken to those blades. Every snip is a snipe. Mine, not yours. Keep out. The Great British Hedge is thought to have its origins in the Bronze Age, and perhaps even earlier, in the Neolithic period. Hedges were then used to manage cattle, keeping them separate from crops. An archaeological excavation in Cambridgeshire has revealed a sprig of blackthorn, believed to be a hedge remnant, and it dates from around 2000 BC. Management of hedges for agriculture continued under various invading cultures. First the Romans, then the Saxons. The old English word haga, meaning hedge, is found in legal documents pertaining to land ownership. Hedges of sufficient thickness and thorniness may even have been used as military defenses. Privet is mentioned by Pliny the Elder in his Natural History. Pliny writes that Gaius Marcius, a friend of Julius Caesar, and also Augustus Caesar, invented the art of clipping hedges for ornamental rather than strictly pragmatic purposes. Marcius also translated the Iliad into Latin, thus doing a favor to both Homer and to homeowners. Hedges tend toward anonymity. Unlike trees, those divas forever celebrated for their lofty nobility and their sentinel grace, hedges produce few stars, which is not to say there are none. The so-called Phoenix Hedge in the British suburb of Henlisey is 295 feet long, and it's made up of several species. Around 800 years old, it is a survivor. Age in hedges is, however, a slippery concept. They yearn to stretch up and become mature trees, but pruning keeps them forever young. A hedge is in a state of suspended animation. The individual plants may be ancient and gnarled, because they have never been allowed to grow into a tree, they never reach old age. The British urban hedge, as we know it, first flourished between the wars. Suburban semi-detached houses needed something between and around gardens to mark property areas. Enter the hedge. Enter, too, almost immediately, the association between hedges and conformity. In George Orwell's novel, Coming Up for Air, George Fatty Bulling looks out one sour morning over a pokey back lawn enclosed by privet, and he feels trapped. In the Harry Potter books, the beastly Dursleys live on Privet Drive. Their address shorthand for small-mindedness in suburbia. In London, during this strangest of years, hedges came to reflect the national mood. In Herne Hill, where the Victorian polymath John Ruskin had, as a child, admired a garden hedge of gooseberry and currant bushes, the letters BLM for Black Lives Matter were sheared into a privet. In Walthamstow, birthplace of the 19th century textile designer William Morris, who once created a topiary dragon from a yew in his garden, another privet became a public statement. Hannah Auerbach George, a weaver in her 20s, took up her trimmer and cut NHS for the National Health Service, Britain's system of free universal health care. She trimmed that into the hedge in front of the house, an expression of solidarity with those on the front line of the battle against the coronavirus. Yet hedges do not always bring people together. This past summer, at a home in Glasgow, Scotland, a person noticed that their neighbor's gardener was cutting the hedge that separated the properties. The person had trimmed this only the week before, employing his signature, which is a rough and ready style. But now the gardener was making it so flat that one could play billiards on top. So he sallied forth and questioned the technique. He questioned mine. And we questioned each other again. This was a debate with deep roots. Nature finessed by human artistry. And this goes all the way back to Lancelot Capability Brown, the landscape architect of the mid-18th century. The neighbor's gardener, favoring a greater formalism, allied himself with André Le Nôtre, the genius of Versailles. He defended that position, not in French, but in vigorous Scots. Ear F, your head, crazy, sick. This was unpleasant, but such conflicts can escalate. In 2003, an argument over a hedge led a man to shoot his neighbor and then take his own life. 2 years later, a man in his 70s was found guilty of urinating under cover of night on his neighbor's hedge, a long-term campaign to kill it that earned him the tabloid nickname, the Midnight Piddler. The neighborhood hedge is a figure of dispute, also in a British newspaper. The hedge in British culture has a fragile dignity. It is always at risk of being considered a joke, which is unfair. Hedges are an undervalued form of urban green infrastructure. Garden hedges provide an effective filter between our homes and traffic pollution, and they mitigate flooding, reduce noise, and act as wildlife corridors. Hedges are also an admirably versatile metaphor. In Brexit Britain, they are a barrier. In COVID Britain, they are a frontier. This far, but no farther. Most of all, in a Britain battered by recent economic and political storms, they are a much needed hug. Other nations love their hedges too, of course, but only in Britain do they seem so bound up with national identity. The hedge speaks to the romantic idea of the country as a green and pleasant land, but its cheerful dullness undercuts this notion. We get carried away. Our souls are in those hedges, and those hedges are in our souls. And now for something completely different. We're going from a discussion about hedges in Britain to Union or rebel soldier slang during the U.S. Civil War. Each week in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly, there is a column by Melissa Moore. And I often refer to her because she has such interesting subjects. And in the issue for November the 2nd this year, or actually it was last year, wasn't it? 2020, she said this: war is a crucible for the creation of slang. People from different regions are thrown together under intense circumstances, and this mixing of people from diverse backgrounds spurs linguistic innovation. And she says, I've been thinking about the slang that developed during the most polarized period in American history, the U.S. Civil War. Some of the words and idioms are still common in English, while others have gone AWOL, that is, absent without leave, or more broadly, missing, which was first used circa 1863. Shebang is perhaps the most familiar. During the war, it referred to a crude shelter and a shanty. but by 1869 it was commonly paired with whole and used to mean thing, business, as in I'm tired of the whole shebang. Dictionaries won't even hazard a guess about where shebang came from. The Merriam-Webster dictionary notes simply origin unknown. But speculation is rampant about skedaddle. This word means to run away, to flee, make a hasty retreat. And letters from both sides of the war are full of it. Union soldiers reported that the Rebs skedaddled, while Confederates wrote home about how the Yanks skedaddled. By 1867, the word was popular even in England. A character in one of Anthony Trollope's novels describes how her friend's suitor is left in a hurry. "Mama, Major Grantley has skedaddled." Her mother replies, "Oh, Lily, what a word." Like Lily's mother, many officers disdained the slang of the troops. A military journalist summed up this attitude when he called their slang a gross perversion of the language. He made an exception, though, for skedaddle, because it came from good Hellenic stock. Another amateur etymologist thought the word could be attributed to a Harvard student in the Army of the Potomac who knew that Greek skedanoumi means to scatter. The word shoddy now means cheaply imitative or hastily or poorly done, according to the Merriam-Webster Dictionary. During the war, it referred to the cloth from which Union uniforms were sewn. This shoddy was made of old wool fibers, sometimes with a little glue added to strengthen the weave. It was described as poor, sleazy stuff that often dissolved in the rain. The Civil War also produced several new words for money. The word greenbacks were paper notes not backed by gold or silver and which were printed in green ink. This term is still used today. Then there's the word spondulix, also spelled without an X, and spelled spondulix with an L-I-C-K ending. However, this is less common. This would seem to be another Harvard student word derived from the spondylus genus of mussels, whose shells resembled coins. It was used by people across the country. A soldier wrote that he'd welcome a little spondulix from his folks. It would help him out quite a bit. I think it's time today for a few questions and answers. You know, people write into the Smithsonian Institute with questions, and the experts at that institution give them the answers. Well, let's start off with this question. What is the protocol for adding new stars to the U.S. flag? If Puerto Rico another territory or the District of Columbia were to gain statehood, the road to a 51st star flag would be wide open. Back in 1919, President Woodrow Wilson established the Heraldic Program Office, and this was to approve army insignia and coats of arms. A restructured version of that program, the Institute of Heraldry now has designs on deck for flags up to 56 stars. The law states that any new flag shall be unveiled on the next 4th of July. So, that sounds like an easy way to enlarge our flag. Let's see which territories accomplish this. Another question, I've heard that in the 1960s, many American astronauts drove Corvettes. How did that happen? Well, the answer to the question was, it started in 1962 when General Motors presented a white Corvette to Alan Shepard, the first American in space. And then, in a burst of promotional savvy, a Florida Chevrolet dealer named Jim Rathman negotiated with GM to offer astronauts a $1 a year lease on any model in his showroom. Not surprisingly, the Rocketmen chose the flagship sports car. Sometimes they even drag raced on beach roads. And then there's this third question. How do museums transport priceless artifacts without risking theft? Well, it's a vigorous process involving a lot of paperwork, risk-based planning, and on-the-ground protection. William Tompkins, the founding director of the Smithsonian's National Collections Program, had a long career in doing such when he was managing the numismatic collections at the National Museum of American History. Tompkins was assigned to travel to a conference in New York with priceless coins. He made the trip accompanied by plainclothes security officers, and arriving at the conference, Tompkins was greeted by a handful of security guards who looked like they worked for the mafia, he recalls. You could tell they were all carrying weapons. Generally, it's the receiving party's responsibility to foot the bill for all of the necessary security precautions, and I suppose furnish the ammunition too. And one last question. In North America, we worry about invasive species from other continents. Are there North American species that have become invasive elsewhere? Europeans and Asians both dread the Colorado potato beetle, according to Floyd Shockley, who's the entomology collections manager at the National Museum of Natural History. The interloper, commonly found in the Rocky Mountains, destroys eggplant, tomato, and tobacco plants, as well as spuds. The fall armyworm, native to Eastern and Central North America, spread a few years ago to Africa and then to Asia, where it began eating lucrative cash crops like maize and sorghum. And since the late 20th century, the Western corn rootworm, common in Iowa, has been attacking corn plants across Europe. Like the Colorado potato beetle, this pest also causes problems in the U.S., but it's harder to control in Europe than in Asia, where farmers have fewer pesticides to use. Many other American plants and animals, from Virginia to Virginia silkweed to Louisiana crawfish, are wreaking havoc abroad. So it is not only the United States that is fighting invasive species, but also our neighbors in Europe and in Asia. And now, my friends, it's time to pack up and head out of here. Until next time, this is Dan Dillman asking you to be safe. Take care, please. Wear your mask. Remember, social distancing helps us all. I want you to have a good day. And tune in next time to A Little of This, A Little of That. I enjoy having you around, so I'll be waiting here for you when you tune in to 101.5 FM. Good day, my friends, and goodbye.